Kaio Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and creators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. The front fell off, the 94-metre, 100-metre track. Fred Dagg, 24 years of political satire with Brian Dore. These are just a handful of the impactful comedic works from the one and only John Clarke. For over 40 years, John Clarke brought an unparalleled level of wit, politically astute comedic understanding, and pitch-perfect timing to Australian and New Zealand audiences. John Clarke's work as a comedian wasn't just to entertain, but to also make audiences sit and think. Whether it be utilising the landmark comedic series The Games as a way of presenting an apology to the stolen generation of Australia, or by calling out the hypocrisy of the colonial state we live in, John Clarke utilised his comedic genius to masterful effect. In 2017, the world lost John Clarke, and Lauren Clarke lost her father. Now, after having explored over 200 boxes of John Clarke's work and letters, having written a book about her relationship with her dad, and having interviewed countless fellow comedic masters like Sam Neill, Rhys Darby and Ben Elton, among many, many more, Lauren has crafted a documentary about her dad called But Also John Clarke. It's just about one of the most enriching and delightful experiences you'll have this year, even if you're not familiar with John Clarke's work. And I kind of almost envy you if you aren't, as you've got a decades of work to be entertained by. For a film that could quite easily become a hagiography or a maudlin experience, Lauren manages to balance the film with a delightful level of charm and compassion. Compassion not only for the loss of her father, but also for the audience who loved him, her mother, and, most importantly, herself. In the following interview, recorded ahead of But Also John Clarke's world premiere at the Melbourne International Film Festival, Lauren talks about getting the balance right for a film like this, while also touching on the process she undertook to be vulnerable this way. I had an absolute blast watching But Also John Clarke, as I'm sure you will, and I also shed more than a fair few tears too. I also had a real delight being able to talk with Lauren about this particular film, and I really appreciated her vulnerability in some of the questions that I ask her as well. And I know, and you'll hear, I know how difficult it is to jump onto a Zoom with a stranger and to have a conversation about something that is really quite personal. But that's the power of being able to be open and sharing a story with strangers through a film or through an interview like this. The documentary screens at MIFF from the 15th of August to the 24th of August with select Q&A sessions with Lauren in attendance. So please head along if you can and buy tickets via miff.com.au in advance. Additionally, if you want to find out more about the work that we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au or follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Blue Sky at thecurb.au. We are a completely independent and ad-free website that lives on support of listeners and readers just like yourself. So if you can, visit patreon.com/thecurb.au where you can support our work from as little as $1 a month. And if you're unable to financially support us, that's okay. Please consider sharing this interview with your film-loving friends. We'd also love it if you could rate and review us on the podcast player of your choice. Every review helps amplify the interviews and stories from filmmakers to a wider audience. New interviews drop on Thursdays, with bonus chats appearing on Tuesdays. You would have just heard that a new bonus chat dropped on the other day, which was with producer Bethany Bruce about her documentary Make It Look Real, which is now on Netflix. Right, here is the trailer for But Also John Clarke, followed by my chat with director Lauren Clarke.
Cool. What's that? What is it?
My whole life, people ask me what it was like to have John Clarke as a dad.
Shut up, Lauren's father.
Here's a daughter.
There's a beach down there.
That is a lesser spotted smartass.
His audience felt they knew him personally.
This is the most exciting I've ever seen London. I've never seen this many people, and I personally have seldom been this excited.
Putting the rapier in deep.
He was utterly unique. He could write, he could perform, he could knock up a poetry. There's nothing he couldn't do.
What makes someone go on to become a satirist in two countries?
If we're starting the story of you and how you came to be you, where do we start?
The actual key to him is his absolute visceral loathing of authority.
I remember the headmaster saying to me, "We are going to break your spirit." So I thought, "We'll bring it on, son."
He always said his strength was that he came from his audience.
G'day. How you doing? All right? It's the story.
Get out of there!
He said, "Look, we can actually have fun with who we are." Kind of like a kick in the head with a gumboot that we all kind of needed.
We don't know how lucky we are, mate. We don't know how lucky we are.
There was an enormous fuss about it, of course.
Television got bombarded with letters saying that I was a disgrace.
Fred Dagg might have made quite a few people laugh lately, but the Prime Minister is not one of them.
It's almost like he knew them personally, too.
Was that you?
Huh?
Must have been me. Sorry.
One of the complicated things, I imagine, for you about talking about this film is that it is so deeply personal, and it's an invitation to your life, but also your father's life too. And that's such a generous thing to be able to do, is extend this invitation to audiences to say, if you don't know him, that's great. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him and, you know, enrich your day a little bit. But for people like myself who did grow up watching his work, we feel like it's an invitation to sit at the table and just kind of listen to his life a bit more. And that's such a difficult thing, to kind of put yourself out in the open in this way, in such a personal way. How did you get to the mindset of, this is what I need to be able to do to share his story with the world?
With enormous reluctance initially, and you've pinpointed so many things that are central to the film in just that question, because first of all, our family, my mum, my sister and my dad, four of us, when Dad came to Australia, he changed a couple of him. He sort of saw it as a chance to sort of start over on a few levels. And he's never said this, but it's quite clear to me that one of the things he changed when he came to Australia was allowing access to the press to him. So there is a famous photo in our family of, it's a just picture of sort of like tussocks spread out across an open plain with a huge sky. And in the distance, there is a teeny tiny little dot that is probably a person. And that is the photograph that he used to send to journalists when they asked for an approved photo of his wife, my mum, Helen, because he didn't want and she didn't want the family to sort of be part of the John Clark that was being accessed by his audience. And that's a pretty difficult trick to pull. But he seems to have managed it. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't do media, but he was very select with that. He talked about the family rarely, if at all, and it would just be sort of an all-encompassing statement, which is surprising to people who knew him, because we just hung out together and we just were always together, and family was a huge part of his life, his kids and mum. And your expression that you used, which I feel like you've read my mind and been sitting in on the process the entire time, was sitting around the table. You've been invited to sit around the table. One of the ideas that I started off with this film is that people, that sort of John Clark persona that he was in public, and if you didn't know him, it's still interesting, because I think it's interesting because I think people, we are like this, we contain multitudes, to use a cliche, but and so his sort of that persona, or that sort of that public John Clark, when I was a kid, people used to ask all the time, what's it like to have him as a dad? Which is an impossible question for a child to answer, let alone an adult, because I didn't have any other dads against which to measure whatever they were asking. And it was a question that I faced my entire life. And then I realized
people sort of want to know, when they're asking that question, they want to know, is he like I imagine him? You know, and to me, it is like there's a sort of iceberg and they see the tip of the iceberg and we see all the rest of it. And there isn't any inherent conflict there, but there's a lot of context that helps explain it in a bigger way, in a more interesting way. And that's where my first idea that I had was that we literally open at the kitchen table, or a kitchen table, it didn't even have to be ours, but with just scripts all over it, because in our family we would do table reads all the time. So if he had a script like the games, he didn't do it with Clark and Dorr because they were just, he just whipped those little interviews off, those satirical interviews he did with Brian Dorr. He'd write those and then he'd go in and they'd rehearse them and off it went. It's sort of a muscle memory thing after a while. But with new things, we'd gather around and we'd read his new script that he'd been working on. And I'd play a part and my sister would play a part and my mum would play a part. And if there was someone over or if, you know, there were friends who remember coming to these, and I did them with my plays, because I was, you know, in my 20s, I started writing theatre shows and putting them on at university and then eventually putting them on in Melbourne. And sometimes you'd invite the cast if you're a bit further down the... And so it became this sort of exchange, and partly that was the idea of having that motif was about the work and life being the same and public and private being the same, but all of them being different and all of that. So you've hit on something that's not even in the film anymore, but, and the reason is that that actually we needed to simplify. Part of the arduous job of the film was really simplifying the storytelling and what exactly it was we were saying. But yeah, those are the things that to me, I ended up thinking, you know, I could tell this story in a way that sort of respected the privacy that my family's protected, but also, you know, it is one of the things I love about creative work is like this story, you've got a blank page on day one, it could be 4,000 million things. So what's it going to be? But you're right. On a personal level, it is a bit daunting. But I think being the director of the film and being the writer of the film, having that control over what exactly the sort of version of the story is that I'm going to tell, that's been the key. So when the producer actually said, you know, you need to tell this and you need to direct it, I think that if that hadn't been the case, I wouldn't have gone near it.
Yeah, yeah. So with that in mind then, how do you separate, I mean, it's probably impossible to separate the mindset of being a daughter and a director and then knowing what to actually include in those regards. And you've kind of already touched on that, but that's a complicated relationship to hold in both hands.
Yeah, it is. And there are a couple of things where during the process I've thought, now here I feel myself being protective of my mum and my sister and my dad, and I don't mean protective in any sort of major way. I just mean sort of artistically and of their privacy and things like that. And I've thought, but the way that I need to tell this story is it's either got to be this or this. And I think in any documentary making, if you've got there has to be a sense of kind of ethical reactivity. Like you sort of do need to think, now there will be people watching this. There will be people taking this from, taking whatever, you know, taking this from that scene that I may not have thought of. You do need to think about that. I think you have a real responsibility to do that if it's documentary. But I also think that this far into my creative sort of career, I mean, I'm almost 50 myself, you know, to that you actually you do know, right, I've either got a storytelling problem I need to solve or I need to figure out what it is I want to say, who I'm going to disappoint, who I need to consult. But it does feel a little bit like storytelling, but the thing that sort of, and I've had this my whole life, you know, my dad was sort of well known before. I don't remember that not being the case. So I sort of have shared him, and my sister and I have shared him with all of the people around us. But to me, the moment, so that sort of public-private thing isn't certainly I'm so conscious of, but when we finally watched an edit that felt like the story that I wanted to tell, I was so moved. And the thought in my head, there were just two words, and they were, "Hi, Dad." Like, there was my dad. It was like he was back. He was in the room. It wasn't really, but it was so validating, because and that's both a personal thing and a sort of creative thing. It's like, you know, we've done the table read and it's a few weeks later and we've taken out all the red marks with bits where that person talked for too long and the monologue obviously went too long, and we've put the funny bit back in, and here's the piece of work. So there's that creative moment, but it was also a personal one for me, because what I had wanted to do was show who he was, and there he was.
I think, and I hope I can frame this kind of question in a sensitive way, the feeling that I was left at the end was not a sense of mourning that he's gone, but rather that he was given the chance to exist at all, and given the chance to be creative and build what he did over those years. And I think that's a beautiful feeling, because we still, like, as an audience, we've, you know, mourn that he's gone, of course, just like you do. But knowing that there was a space for him to be able to create what he did is equally beautiful. And that level of joy and brilliance and beauty that we're left with is such a lovely gift to be able to give people. Was that kind of the note that you wanted to leave on?
You have made my day, because I really wanted, it was really hard to get that ending right. And I think it's even been tweaked since you've seen it, because I know it's important when you sort of, it's essentially a tribute to a really interesting cat, you know. And so you sort of do need to say, look, he was wonderful in these ways and he's missed in these ways. You need, the audience wants to feel that a little bit. But one of the things I really wanted to do with that moment is to then just lift it slightly as a sort of a, he says in the start of the film, and he and we recorded ourselves having conversations, and they're all through the film. And I was asking him about his life. And at one point I say to him, how would you tell the story? And he says, look, I don't think my biography is the point. I think maybe my perspective might be the point. And I used that as a bit of a guide, because I think his perspective is one of the things that's really unusual about him. He was typical of his generation. He had a really typical experience growing up in New Zealand with parents who'd survived the war. But that typical experience is pretty intense, and it wasn't a great time. You know, I had a joyful, hilarious childhood, which just felt like the most natural thing in the world. That's not his experience. And his perspective, I think, is to find the joy. So joy was like to find connection always. And when he came up against the system not loving him, which happened rather a lot, or not rather a lot, but happened as much as it happens to anybody, you know, he came up against a school system that didn't like him. He came up against, we all do in creative work. You've got to sometimes fight for something in your creative work. And he always made it a real priority to connect and to like find joy in the little things. Like he would talk to anybody. I mean, that's a famous, I mean, where he died, we just, the number of people who said, I met him and spoke to him for 2 hours in the street. And we're all like, well, that would have been the time that he didn't turn up for lunch, 553. But that was him connecting and like finding out stuff about people. And I think that's why his audience thought that they saw him. He saw them rather. So the relationship was somehow sort of a two-way experience. So, and what that means, what I hope that means is that when people leave, they think, let's do more of that. Maybe life isn't about all of the stuff that we're bombarded with every day. Maybe life is about that stuff. And that's not to say that life is fair and that other things aren't dreadful, like they are, but we have sort of all we've got is each other, our imaginations, and like, let's go from there.
One of the things which I'd always appreciated about his work was providing context to politics and the current day. And, you know, certainly the work that he did with Brian, deeply important, but it also, you know, he touched on so many different things, global issues, local issues, all these different kinds of things. And for a lot of people, that was an entry point into the news of the day or the politics of the day through the satire. And what I love is the way that you weave in context of historical context of his life, but also the history of New Zealand, people going to war, your family's history, and then Australian history too. And so it's this dual narrative of John's history, your family's history, but also global history too. How important is it to be able to delve into that kind of, providing that context of politics and what was going on in both Australia and New Zealand?
Yeah, really important to me. When I told Mum that I was thinking of doing the film, she said, I just don't want it to be a hagiography, which I had to Google, but which I realised what she meant was that she doesn't want it, she didn't want it to just be, hey, this guy was funny. You know, wasn't he hilarious? What a gifted, hilarious guy. He was more than that. I mean, Sam Neill describes him in the film as a bit of an intellect. You know, he did have that. He wasn't doing comedy that was, I mean, that he did some, but he's known for doing comedy that taps into what's going on in the world. And that, I think, is quite a deliberate decision by him. And I think if you're making a film about him and you're saying he was a really fun, nice guy, which is what everybody says, especially when his daughter is asking the questions. But you know, he was a likable dude. You would have, you know, bumped into him in a bakery and chatted to him in the line and thought he's fun, you know. That's just who he was. But if you're telling that story, maybe the most interesting thing about that story is why he's like that and what is it that's motivating him to do that. And with him, you didn't die wondering. He'd tell you. We talked about that stuff all the time, you know. So you would, you know, like you would, I would say something like, I remember saying once that I was thinking I was going to fail. I was going to fail an exam. I was finishing a law degree. I'd loved the first part of it. And then I had just stumbled into the, what I called the capitalism years, which were like, you know, trust accounts and corporations law and things. And I just couldn't even, I just couldn't make my brain play. And I said, I've got this exam. I think I might even fail it. Like I just have no grasp on it whatsoever. And he said, I don't want to boast, Loz, but I am the clubhouse leader when it comes to failing things. And then he just went through and he sort of just deconstructed, is a bit of a strange word for it, but he did. He deconstructed my anxiety about what I was facing, you know, And he pointed out what mattered about what I was doing. And he pointed out what I knew. And he pointed out about the things that I didn't know. And he sort of like just sort of managed to zoom out and in at the same time in a way. And he did that all the time. That was so I sort of, I would have been fine if somebody had made a documentary about, because people did tributes and so on. There's a half hour or a 20-minute one that was done after he died, which is kind of, here's what you want to know about that guy, and here are some funny bits and stuff. But I think to me that historical context and the political context and the sort of the degree to which he is both tapping into the things that are broken in society and attempting in some way to, and this is me saying this, not him, but attempting in some way to sort of empower the audience to decode. That to me is really important. One of his favourite bits of feedback that he got was a woman who came up to him and said, "I like your interviews you do with Brian Dore." And he said, "Oh, that's nice. I'm glad you like those. I'm only trying to help. We're doing what we can, Brian and I," or something. You know, he did something like that. But she looked at him and she was quite serious. She wasn't willing to be dismissed. And she said, "No," she said, I think they do something really interesting to me. I watch them with a straight face and then I laugh at the news." And to him, that was a lovely sort of recognition of that sort of like, we're having fun, aren't we, is the kind of tone, but that there's a sort of a decoding going on that is a little bit democratic and collaborative. So that's the thing that I really wanted to make sure I included. And as I say these things, it's totally overthinking the film. The film is funny and fun, and you're not sitting an exam, I hope, while you're watching it. But these are just the little things that while I was putting it together, I was mindful of.
But I think this is where you meet your dad on his level with the film, is that it is funny and fun. You are laughing throughout most of it and are just having a blast. But then in the hours after watching it, you're like, oh, hang on, my mind's unpacking all of this stuff, and you're going through all this stuff, and which is what he did with Brian. It's what he did with the games, you know, and it's like all of these things. Like, I've worked in local government here in Perth for 10 years now, and we still refer to a lot of the stuff that was going on, like in the interviews with the games and like with Utopia, and we're always making references because he spoke to a level of bureaucracy which it was just like, this can't really be happening, right? And it's like this level of unpacking reality in a way that gives you the tools to be able to say, have a laugh about it, but think about it and try and change it in a better way. Which is beautiful. And I think your film does that too.
Oh, that's so great that you do. Thank you. Well, I one of the things I remember explaining, because hilariously this experience has been, I've sort of been describing his approach to creativity while I make something creative that involves him. And you do come up against certain sort of tropes or rules or conventions or whatever in production, in post-production, in marketing, things like that. And to some extent, like, you're talking about somebody who's a bit of a unicorn, like he doesn't quite fit the mold of what they're describing. Like, I can see how he had to do everything himself, because he had a manager back in the early days, but he was the one that made decisions, and he invented new things all the time. Like like Fred Dagg had never been anyone with a Kiwi accent on TV, being a complete idiot, speaking off the cuff. That had just never happened. And then when he did Clark and Dore, that had never been done before. And then when I say when he did it, when he and Brian did it, but he actually had started as a written piece, and the idea was a sort of slow burn. But all of those things, he sort of was inventing them, you know, as he went. And I think it's one of the things I remember explaining to somebody along the way in the marketing process or in the something, you know, somebody who wasn't part of our core team. And I said, go online and look at the Clark and Dorr videos, because in the comments you will see, because it's international and a lot of them are American, a lot of them are from Finland and whatever, you know. And they say things like, I do not know what this video is about, but I find it hilarious. Or they say, oh, nothing changes. It's just like what happened last week in, you know, Dutch politics or something. And in a sense, I think that thing of with the games, you know, does it really happen like this? He always said about the games, it could almost have been about the ABC, not the Olympics. It could have been about, you know, the idea was it was a sort of an institution. And, yeah, so there's a sort of an awareness of that built in, I think. And it's interesting to watch them go online. Yeah, I mean, they've been online for ages, but it's interesting to watch people learn about those interviews now still and find meaning in there, where, like, there's a video, one of the most viral things they ever did was the front fell off, which is, you know, Senator Collins from 1989 or something, lost to us all, even really what the context was. But people pick up on all sorts of things inside those contexts. So it's kind of interesting to look back and realize that it was a bit of a slow burn, and it started as a piece of writing, and then it went to radio, and then because it sort of helps you understand how something so different could suddenly come out of nowhere. The answer often is that it didn't come out of nowhere.
I know that you've written a book about your life with your dad, and now this film.
Yeah.
And I guess on a really kind of, and this is the heavy question, I guess, in some capacity, is how do you keep yourself kind of mentally safe as you're sharing your life with your dad, with an audience through these different mediums, books, films? How do you keep yourself mentally safe in that process?
Yeah, that's a great question that nobody's ever thought of to ask me, but it's a big one, because my friends and family do, of course, but I think piece of work, people quite rightly will think, oh, well, she was okay with making it because she made it and it's fun and it's a loving tribute and all of that. And it is all of those things, but I think everybody's experience of grief is sort of complicated by something that's particular to their lives. And mine is that I shared him with people in sort of that just him being well known sense, and then all of a sudden the day he died, and it was sudden and it was out of nowhere, I went from being a private person that nobody had heard of except in my own work to suddenly my work was this, and I sort of had to decide whether I wanted to run away from that or sort of run with it. And in a way, that process, like I've told this story before, but I just think of it all the time. I once interviewed on radio Alison Bechdel, you know, from the Bechdel test and from Fun Home, and brilliant, brilliant writer, brilliant observer. Dad would have loved, in fact, I can't remember if I've showed if I showed him her work, but just those little bits, so little intricate details of life. Anyway, I interviewed her and she was sort of not very forthcoming. And then I asked her, because she's written these beautiful, she's written a tribute to her mom and a tribute to her dad in the form of a comic novel each. And I said, when you think of those memories now, like if I describe to you this scene, and I'd look and I read a bit of a scene, and she said, yeah. And I said, what are you picturing? Are you picturing the memory? And she said, no, I'm picturing the what you've written. I can picture it written in the book. And I've never forgotten that, because I think that, you know, the catharsis of creative work is a myth for a reason, right? It's something about the act of translating it into something it does do a job for you. It does a beautiful job for you. What is where you have to keep yourself safe though is when I think it's the sort of constancy of it, you know, and the fact that you are in it and you're talking about it this week, whether you like to or not, and you, all of that stuff, which, again, it's part of my work, so I kind of do it. But sometimes you'll find yourself 2 days later swearing in traffic at something and you'll think, whoa, where'd that come from? You know, so having a bit of a, like recognizing, I suppose, that there's a lot going on even when your conscious mind is actually sorting through some stuff and it feels like it's going all right. That's where the rubber meets the road, I think, on with that stuff. I think we can catch ourselves unawares in those moments. And, you know, like one of the things in my that's different from me between me and my dad is that, and that I touch on in the film, is that he had a fear of flying, or just a like allergy. He couldn't do it. He couldn't bring himself to in the end. And he was fine with that, but he said, I don't need to travel. I like where I am. I like where I am. That's a typical dad line. But also, you know, and he said, what is it? Like I quizzed him about it. And he said, well, you don't see me getting on any ship to go anywhere. I just want to be, I don't love, you know. And he said, but to him, that was a box into which he put all of his anxiety. And he could shut the box. So he just left the box in the corner. And so for me, I think part of this is remembering not to box it up in the documentary, not to box it up in the book. It's okay that it's with you all the time. And yet also talking to people about it always is part of my process, but it's been a big thing. It's been a big, sort of, I kind of found myself doing both of those projects. And one of the things I'm really looking forward to is going to the next thing. And in a way it's helped me too creatively, because I do write more personally now and I have become a bit more open in my work. There is something lovely about what that's done for me, and I'm looking forward to more of that.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful answer. And I know, because I'm painfully conscious of jumping on a Zoom like we do, right? And majority of the time, people on the other end have no idea who I am. So I'm a relative stranger to them. And then I go on and ask them all these very personal questions and they give me these wonderful answers. And then I'm always conscious of like the gift of information and the gift of self, right? And this immediacy, like you're talking about people meeting your dad on the street and spending 2 hours talking to him. It's this immediacy of connection that we as an audience have an immediate connection with somebody else, but that person doesn't have that connection. Like it's a one-way relationship, yeah, right? And so here I am asking all these deeply personal questions and stuff, and the answers are always beautiful, but I'm also conscious about the part of the reason why I ask those questions is the mental safety of people. I'm conscious that as soon as we jump off a Zoom, like you might be thinking about all these questions that I've asked or the answers that you've given or, you know, that going forward. And I know that now you're going to be hitting the whole media trail and talking about your dad and talking about the film. And it's going to be great because people are going to love the film. But then I'm also conscious of that notion of what happens afterwards, right? And keeping yourself safe in that capacity. And I think you know to do for yourself, but it's something that I tend to ask and think about so much as an interviewer. And I don't know if everybody does.
I don't think people do. And I think it's beautiful that you do, because I think, like, I know a lot of people who, one friend of mine, for instance, she did a show about her trauma, and it was partly cathartic for her, and it was a sort of to do with mental illness and so on. And she did it so that people who had similar experiences would feel seen and so on. But the line at the end of the show of people who had come to say, I feel seen, and here's my story. I mean, I remember saying to her, the theatre needs to hire a psychologist or something to sit there with those people, talk to them about their experience. You can be there if you like, but just not the burden of having that emotional, that is the risk you take when you do any sort of work. And in a way, though, I think the risk for me is pretty low, because people have said to me, oh, my father, this happened to my dad or my mum or whatever. It's kind of why you make the work as well. Like, it is about that connection. So it's a little bit just being aware that all of those things can be true at the same time.
Definitely. As a last question, and this is probably one you're going to get asked a bunch, and it's probably a very personal question, I guess, in some regards, but also one that I, you know, so if you don't feel like sharing it, that's okay. But is there a particular comedic moment from your dad's life that sticks with you as the one that is like brings the most joy?
Oh, there are so many of them in this film. I just love them. There's a ridiculous scene in a used car sales yard, which from a film I think called Never Say Die, anyway, where he is selling a terrible car. And it's the delivery of it. It's just so funny. I actually love the way, and I tried to include a fair bit of it in the film, I love the way Dad tells a story, like in how he talks, and sometimes he'll be talking and he'll sort of interrupt a thought and like do a little impersonation or cut himself off or something. Those are the little things for me, and I know there are some stupidly funny jokes in some of those early Fred Dagg things that I'm glad are in there, including at one of the Trevs asking if the horse is sick, which you'll have to tune into the film to see why that's funny. But yeah, to me, it's those little, it's him.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the film. It's beautiful. Yeah, I've really appreciated being able to explore it with you.
Oh, it's been an excellent, excellent conversation, as I knew it would be, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this chat with Lauren Clark, whose documentary about her dad, but also John Clark, has its world premiere at MIFF this August. Visit miff.com.au for tickets. For other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. Please rate, review and share this interview with your film-loving friends. We hope they like it as much as you have. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and I'll see you on the next one.